about the Pope. Otherwise, people are going to be wondering, what have I got to do with the Pope? What happened was that there was a young priest who had developed an alcohol problem and was in intensive care for 5 days, almost died as a result of the alcoholism. And the day he came out of intensive care, he kept on repeatedly asking the nurse for mouthwash. Because mouthwash contains alcohol. And I told them that if he was so severely addicted to craving alcohol that knowing he had been at death's door, that he still kept on drinking after that, that the only way that he could save his life is by going on a medication which will make it impossible for him to drink. Medication known as antabuse makes you violently, violently ill if you drink afterwards. And so he said that he could not possibly take that medication because he has to say the Mass and take a sip of wine. And I said, well, then you can use grape juice. And he said, no, we can't use grape juice. It's not provided for. I had befriended a previous bishop in Pittsburgh who became cardinal and had a very high place in the Vatican. So I went out of my office and I called the cardinal and I said, now, cardinal, we've got to save this guy's life. Can we get a dispensation so that he would be permitted to use grape juice instead of wine for the Mass? And the cardinal promised me that he would personally hand carry it to the Pope, and he called me 3 days later that the Pope had signed a dispensation that an alcoholic priest is permitted to use grape juice for the Mass. So that's the story that Rabbi Adlerstein was referring to. I am addicted to Torah. I have been since I was a child. And like every typical addiction, you need more and more every day. And whatever you have is not enough. But this happens to be a constructive addiction. The other addiction that I have is to writing. And it's true, I've written a great deal, but I've written because I go crazy if I don't write. Somebody once asked me how many books I've written, so I made a calculation. I think it's about 19. But the truth is that I haven't written 19 books. I have written one book in 19 different ways. And if you really read any one of them, you've essentially read them all. So my question is, if you people have not read the books, well, that's not good for business, you know, why haven't you? And if you have read the books, what are you here for? You think I withheld any information that I didn't put in the books? Or do you think that since I've written the books, I've gathered new information? Can assure you not. Anything I learned anymore is by osmosis. Nothing new is going to sink in. But I do want to share with you an important theme about those books, because one of the books actually has the title, Life's Too Short, Pulling the Plug on Self-Defeating Behaviors. Now, I have been in the business of working with people in recovery from alcohol and drugs for 30-some years, and it's probably the prototype of self-defeating behaviors. Clearly, anyone who uses alcohol and drugs the way we use it in addiction is destroying oneself. And yet people continue to do it, sometimes fully aware of what the consequences might be. And yet they make a decision essentially to drink. And one recovering alcoholic told me, he says, you know, never in my life did I ever take a drink unless I decided it was the right thing to do at that time. So there is some kind of thought process that goes on that justifies for him or her, and I'm very careful to say him or her, because I don't want people to get the impression that alcoholism and addiction is purely a male disease. It's another way of denying the problem, by saying it doesn't exist in women, or it doesn't exist in Jews, or it doesn't exist here, but it exists everywhere. But we are capable of making a judgment of doing something that's to our own detriment. And it's interesting that in Torah we find when the prophets exhort the people and reprimand them for being errant and not behaving the way they should, at least 25 times that I have counted, and I am not a real scholar to be able to cite all these sources, but at least 25 times they've used the metaphor of intoxication, reprimanding the people by saying, you stumble although not with wine. You wander around aimlessly although not with ale. And what they're saying is, you know, we call this in the business a dry drunk. A dry drunk is somebody who's been frightened off of alcohol for health reasons or whatever, and so he or she stops drinking or stops using drugs, but have not made any change in their character and in their personality. And so we say, hey, they're dry. They're not drinking any. Right? But the behavior hasn't changed. And this essentially is what the Navi, what the prophet was saying. You people are behaving self-destructively, although not with intoxication. But from that perspective, I was led to look at other kinds of things we do. And I became aware that there are many self-destructive behaviors that many people have, but we are as unaware of the self-destructive behaviors that are less dramatic, we are as unaware of them as the alcoholic or the cocaine addict is unaware of his or her self-destructive behavior. Now, many of these self-destructive behaviors that I'm referring to are not that dramatic, and they actually go under the guise of being normal. Okay? But they're nevertheless self-destructive. I'll give you a couple of examples shortly. I think that they all have one source. I think that they have a source in the fact, in a very simple rule. And the rule is that in order to have a constructive and well-adjusted approach to reality, you have to perceive reality correctly. If you don't perceive reality correctly, you're gonna get into trouble. For example, guy comes into the psychiatrist's office and goes on a couch. The psychiatrist says, all right, now tell me your problems. He says, well, I have a 44-room mansion, and it's located on 400 beautiful acres of countryside. And I have a housekeeper and a cook and a governess for my children. And I have three limousines and a chauffeur. And the doctor interrupts him and he says, now, I ask you to tell me your problems. He says, well, I'm just about to get to that. You see, I only make $150 a week. Now, see, this guy's got problems, right? Because if he is under the delusion that he is a multi-billionaire, and he's distorted reality in that fashion, he's going to get into trouble. But by the same token, what about if it's the other way around? What about if a person is actually much more skilled, much more talented, much more gifted than he believes? And instead of having a delusion, a grandiose delusion, that he is chief of the world court or president of the United States or whatever, or a multi-billionaire, he has a delusion about himself of, oh, I don't really have much going for me. I'm not that bright. I'm not that personable. I'm not that desirable a friend or a companion. There's really nothing all that good about me. Now, if that's not valid, that's a distortion of reality. Now, it so happens that I am very much a part of my reality. In fact, I'm probably the single most important piece of my reality. And you are the single most important piece of reality. And my question is, do you know that part of reality? Do you know yourself? Because if you don't know yourself, and if, for example, you are the victim of one of the common quirks that we underestimate ourselves and that we are actually much better than we think we are, then you're going to have problems. You're going to have problems coming out of that misperception of reality. Now, how good are we really? Well, there's a fascinating part of the Talmud that quotes a verse in Torah where God asks of us that we be holy because I, your God, am holy. You be holy because I, your God, am holy. And the Midrash says that the verse is, the correct interpretation of the verse is that God is saying, you might think that you may be as holy and as great as I am. Yoho kamoni, you think you might be as holy and as great as I am, that you can't. My holiness is superior to yours. Now, one of the Musar authorities, one of our ethicists said, how absurd is it, how would man ever think that he could be as great and as holy as God himself? Why does the Torah even have to warn us? Don't think you can be as great as God himself. It's a total absurdity. And he says, that is because man's true greatness is so enormous that if he really were aware of it, he might well believe that he is close to God himself. Okay. Now, are we aware of our own potential if we are far from recognizing that we are almost as great as Almighty God himself? How many of us think of ourselves as having that kind of potential? Which means that we are all underestimating ourselves. And when I say all, I'm not making any exceptions, because I have no reason to believe that you are any different than I was. And at the ripe old age of 38, I had already been the rabbi for 10 years, and I had already been practicing psychiatry for 5 years, and then I discovered about how severely I was underestimating myself. And the kinds of things that we're doing that were actually, if not destructive, were counterproductive. All because of a self-underestimation. Let me give you a simple example. I was asked to give a series, a morning and afternoon lecture at the South Carolina School of Summer Studies for a review course for counselors in alcoholism and drug addiction. 110 counselors had signed up for that summer course. And I gave a lecture in the morning and a lecture in the afternoon, and I truly believed that I had done a fairly good job. Now today, if you take any course for credit, you have to fill out an evaluation form at the end. About a month later, I get an envelope, thick envelope, a packet of 110 evaluation forms about my sessions. And as I paged through them, my ego went right through the ceiling. You should have seen the wonderful things that people were saying about the evaluation of my lecture. It was great. 109 fantastic evaluations. And one negative one. One critical one. And I went around depressed for 3 weeks. Until it dawned upon me that a score of 109 to 1 isn't bad. And that 109 people can't be wrong. But for a long period of time, I had gone around totally devastated, as though I was able to pull the wool over and deceive 109 people, but this one guy, he saw through my act. Now, we all can probably use constructive criticism. But how do we react to when anybody says something critical to us? Right? How sensitive are we to criticism? You know, those of us who are still walking around with a negative self-concept like I used to have, are very much like a person with a severe sunburn Because you see, if a person has a severe sunburn and you just brush against them, he may wince with pain. Not because he was hurt by a blow from somebody, but because the touch was on that very sunburned, sensitive skin, elicited pain. However, being that he realizes, oh, that person did not mean to harm me. It's my sensitivity that caused this pain. It's not his harmful, his hostile intent. Well, that's because we can see the sunburn. But what if we've got a sunburned emotional makeup? What if we are so sensitive because we don't feel adequate about ourselves? And somebody says something to us which we can interpret negatively. We react as though that person had aggressed against us. And we make an enemy out of that person because of something he said where it wasn't what he said, it was our own reaction to it. This happens so often, and yet it's just a variety of normal, and we pay the price for it. Now, let me show you just how far off we can be in our own self-evaluation. Back in 1972, there was a young woman, a board-certified pediatrician, who had a severe alcohol problem and ended up in her being fired from her job. She came in for treatment. After I interviewed her several times, I realized from the interviews that this was a woman who was superior in many, many ways. Very excellent and accomplished, but her own feelings about herself were devastating. Total feelings of inadequacy, inferiority, worthlessness. And so one time I sat down and I said to her, make me a list of some of your good qualities. Tell me something positive about yourself. And she couldn't say anything. So I opened up a chart and I said, now I'm going to show you some factual information. It says here, in your background, that you graduated college summa cum laude. You can't do any better than that. You won the Phi Beta Kappa Award. Can't do any better than that. They don't give those out to imbeciles. Now, when I asked you to tell me something positive about yourself, assuming that you couldn't think of anything else to say, you could have said, well, all right, well, whatever it's worth to you, I'm not stupid. I won the Phi Beta Kappa. And her response to me was, well, when they told me that I won the Phi Beta Kappa Award, I knew they'd made a mistake. You see, if you're down on yourself, someone can confront you with factual information to the contrary, and you won't accept it. And feelings of inadequacy are the single greatest paralyzing force that drive us not only into alcohol, not only into drugs, into food addiction, into gambling addiction, into sexual addiction, into a kind of, not ambition, because ambition is good, but in trying to prove ourselves to the point where we'll get coronaries in the process and destroy ourselves while we're trying to prove that we're really okay. And the fact is that we should have no reason to have to prove anything. I wouldn't be surprised that some of you are still doing what I used to do. And that is that you're people pleasers. That you can't say no to a request. And that you have to do everything for everybody. Now let me be very cautious here. We are commanded by the Torah to do acts of kindness, to do acts of benevolence. And Gemilas Chasadim, doing acts of kindness, is the single greatest mitzvah in the Torah. And we should do a great deal, and we should do more than we're doing. But we should do them because they are a mitzvah, and it is because the proper thing to do. Not because we feel trapped, because otherwise we do it with resentment. For example, father has promised to take his children to the amusement park on a weekend 3 weeks from now. He's going to have a free weekend. And the children are looking forward to it. Daddy's going to take us to the amusement park and we're going to have all the fun and eat some cotton candy and go on the rides, whatever. 3 days before this weekend, neighbor comes over to him and he says, Frank, I wonder if you can give me a hand. I want to paint the garage this weekend and before the rain comes, and I can't do it myself. Could you give me a hand? Now, Ralph is the kind of guy who has had feelings of negativity about himself. He really doesn't believe there's any reason why people would like him. And because he's so desperate to be liked, right, he tries to buy his friendship, to do things for others so that they will like him. God forbid he should offend anyone, because then they won't have any reason to like him at all. And so when this neighbor asks him to help him paint the garage, he doesn't really want to do it because he promised the kids. But he can't say no to him. That's risking. How can I offend somebody? So he says, sure, be glad to help you. Well, that's a lie right there. But he promises to help him. Then he goes and calls the kids and he says, since something came up, I won't be able to make it this weekend. We'll do it another week. And the kids start crying, but you promised. He says, well, yes, I know, but you promised. And he starts getting angry at the kids. Because now he's feeling guilty. Why is he crying the kids? And then the wife comes in. And she says, why are the children crying? You promised you'd take them for them to look into it for the past 3 weeks. So he screams at the wife. And he's angry at her. And he's angry at that SOB who made him promise to take the... Why is he walking all over me? Taking advantage of me. And then he's angry at himself for being such a patsy and giving in. So it ends up he's angry at the whole world. Now, you know, helping somebody is a mitzvah. And doing a mitzvah should not result in getting you angry at the whole world. Doing a mitzvah should give you a good feeling. So if you're in a position where you can afford to say, gee, I wish I could help you this weekend, but I promised the kids, and I just can't deprive the kids of what I promised them, but I'll be glad to do it for you any other day. At that point, you do it for them any other day, and you do it gladly, and you're a good neighbor, and you want to help them, and you enjoy helping them, and you've done a fine mitzvah. And it's great to do a mitzvah, and it's great to do kindness to others, but to be a people pleaser, and to try to satisfy everybody and to buy their friendship because you don't think you can get it for free? That's one symptom. If any of you are doing that, then I think that you owe it to yourself to take a look why. Why do I have to do something to ingratiate myself to others? Can't I assume that if I didn't do it, they would like me just as well? And then go ahead and do many, many good things and do it because you want to do it. I just had a wonderful experience. People in Los Angeles won't possibly understand it because you guys don't have no deep snows over here. Well, we had the blizzard of 96 that visited Pittsburgh, and I was prepared for it this year because having turned 65, I bought myself a snowblower. He told me I wasn't allowed to shovel snow anymore. And so when the blizzard hit, I went down in the morning. I get up very early before davening and got the snowblower and did my driveway, and then the neighbor's driveway was there, and, you know, it takes 5 minutes with that powerful snowblower to do his driveway. Then I went up and did my walk, and then I saw, well, I'm up here already, you know, so I did the neighbor's walk on a couple of houses down there. A couple of houses down there, and it was a good time doing it. I enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. And then I was very pleased that a few days later I got a note from the local yeshiva saying a contribution had been made in honor of Dr. Twisty for shoveling our snow. They see, doing mitzvahs has its payoff, but it's a good feeling to do something. But now when you feel I'm cornered and I've got to do it, because then you react with resentment. Why are people taking advantage of me? So I don't want you to stop doing good things. I want you to do more of them, but do them for the right reason. Now, many of us have the kinds of self-defeating behaviors where because we don't feel good about ourselves and we don't know why we feel distressed, we may turn to things that will help us feel good. And yes, we may use alcohol and we may use drugs and we may use food, which is a very common addiction. And food is supposed to be used for nutrition. If you've already fulfilled your nutritional needs, you're still going for food, you're using it as a drug. And why are you using it as a drug? Because it makes me feel better. Well, what's wrong with you that you're not feeling good? And we've got to stop and take a look. Why am I really not feeling good? And this time I'm not going to say that I'll answer the question by saying I have already written a book about that. Yes, I have. I've written a book about it, but it isn't out yet. It's going to be out in June or July. A book on eating disorders. Titled appropriately, There Is a Thin You Within You. And you just got to discover it. You just got to discover it. But you see, the basic feeling of distress that we may have is a rather simple one. The example that I like to use is, suppose that you have an automobile that has a small engine, a four-cylinder engine that can generate 60 horsepower.
Someone has their lights on in the parking lot, one SSX 574, a maroon Ford. The lights are on. Thank you.
So, let's suppose that you've got this little four-cylinder car, and it's not going to burn up the road, but it'll get you where you want to go. And it'll give you a comfortable, smooth ride. But now let's suppose that you've got a powerful, powerful car, a V8 engine that can generate over 300 horsepower. However, two of the eight cylinders are not operative. Two of the eight cylinders are not functioning. They're not hitting. So it can't do any 300 horsepower. It'll do about 200 horsepower, a little plus. But still more than three times as powerful as the little car. But you're not going to get a smooth ride. It's going to be a very rough ride. Why? Because it's missing cylinders. But isn't it more powerful than the smaller one? Yes, but a four-cylinder machine that's operating on all four cylinders operates smoothly. An eight-cylinder car that's operating on six of the eight does not function smoothly. All right, now, let's suppose that you're an eight-cylinder person. But you're not aware of all the cylinders that you've got. And you think that you're only operating, that you're only capable of doing a four, five, or six cylinder job. You're going to have a rough ride. You're going to be discontent. You're going to feel depressed. You're going to feel awkward, uneasy. And yet, you have no idea why you feel that way. Because most of us aren't aware of that, of the reason for the feeling. But since we feel uneasy, it's only natural we're going to try and find something to make us feel better. So if your excess is to alcohol, then alcohol may make you feel better. And if it's to marijuana or cocaine or heroin, then that'll make you feel better. Okay. And if it's to Napoleons or potato chips or pretzels or chocolate, then that'll make you feel better. Okay. Unfortunately, none of these address the problem. In fact, all of them make you feel worse. Because these chemicals depress your brain and make you feel, make you function more inadequately. The excess weight gives you all kinds of complexes and gives you all kinds of problems, and so you feel more self-conscious and more awkward, whatever, and you feel worse about yourself than before, so you got a vicious cycle. And all that's really necessary is to discover your real potential and to function at it. There are some of us who are so concerned that if we fail at something, that will confirm and reinforce the worst feelings we've had about ourselves. And we are so afraid of that, that we have to take a precaution that we do not possibly fail. Now, I don't like failures any more than you do. I've had my share of them. I don't like them. I like success. I don't like failures. But when failures do occur, I have to take them in stride. They're part of living. But if you're so sensitive, that a failure is not just a failure, but it's a devastation, because it confirms your worst fears about yourself, then by all means you have to avoid failure. Now, how do you avoid failure? Well, there's one simple method to do it. Don't try and you won't fail. You really want to avoid failure? Stay in bed till 4:30 in the afternoon. Stay under the covers. By the time you get going after 4:30, you can't mess things up too bad anymore. Now, you'll never get anywhere, but so what? At least you won't have failed. You'll have made the worst failure at all, of all, because you'll never get anywhere. But at least it's a passive failure, it's not an active failure. Now, maybe there aren't that many people that stay in bed until 4:30 in the afternoon, but there's many people who do the same kind of thing. Will be afraid to try because they're afraid that they're going to fail. And the safest way to avoid failure is not to try. There's some people who have found another way of avoiding failure. And that is, yes, they will do things, and in order to avoid failure, they'll make darn certain that they do it perfectly and take every possible precaution to see that they don't possibly make a mistake. And then you become a perfectionist. Now, there's some degree of perfectionism that is normal and even desirable. And certainly in certain occupations, you would want somebody who has a fair amount of perfectionism. Like when you get into the airplane, you want the pilot to be a perfectionist. And if you knew that the pilot would get into the seat and say, all right, let's get this thing off the ground now. You say, wait a minute, there's a bunch of dials over there. I want you to check them. But on the other hand, if the pilot went in and checked them and checked them and checked them and checked them, and 6 hours later you're still sitting at the gate because he hasn't finished checking his dials, right? I mean, you're not sitting there for the fun of it. You want to get to your destination. So that is a kind of sick perfectionism. But it happens. It happens. And I've seen people destroy themselves with their perfectionism because it was easier to do that than to take the risk that they might fail. And I could give you examples of that, but I don't want to use up all the time. There are people who have done things to themselves physically because of feelings of inadequacy. I remember many years ago, a young woman was admitted to the hospital, and she was at that point quite mentally ill, and she protested that the reason that she is here is because her family refuses to go along with her request to get her special contact lenses to change the color of her eyes. And that if I could convince the family to do that, everything would be fine. Well, going back in her history, I found out that about 2 years before that, she had had plastic surgery to reconstruct her nose. And I talked with the family and I asked them to please bring in pictures of her before the plastic surgery. And they brought in the pictures, and she was a very attractive young woman, and she did not have a deformity of the nose that required cosmetic surgery. And I asked the family, what happened here? Why did you let her go through this procedure that was unnecessary? And they told me that she had seen 3 or 4 plastic surgeons, all of whom refused to operate on her, until she found an unscrupulous surgeon who for money would do anything. And it cost them a fair amount because there was no coverage for this. And I said, now why did you go along with that? And they said, doctor, had you been there, you would have gone along with it also. We had no day, no night. It was constantly crying, I'm unattractive, nobody's ever going to be interested in me, no boy's ever going to want to look at me, and if only you would care for me, you love me, you'd give me the money for the surgery. And they did an unnecessary piece of surgery, and she felt good about herself for a few months, and then started with changing the color of her eyes. And what happened with this young woman, and maybe a little bit of a drastic case, but these drastic cases show the same kinds of things that can happen in other ways. She felt about herself that she was inferior. Help, 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 help.
Yeah. Well, you got some, no? No, we have a regular.
This is a bottle, my son. Again, we're back to some very self-destructive or self-defeating behavior resulting from attempts to deal with to defend against a condition which does not exist. Now you see, if you really have a shortcoming, if you really have a defect, and we're only human and many people have defects, we can do something to counteract and compensate for that defect, if it's a defect in reality. As for example, I know some people who have, as a result of loss of vision, have developed an acute sense of hearing, an acute sense of touch, to compensate for their loss of vision. So, if you have some actual shortcoming, you can compensate for it. The problem is that if you feel a defect, and it doesn't exist anywhere except in your imagination, then no matter how much you compensate for it, it's like trying to fill an empty, a bottomless pit. You'll never be able to succeed. Which means that if we really want to turn away from self-defeating behaviors, that the first thing we've got to do is we've got to discover who we really are. And discover that we're much better than we are. Now, some of us use some kinds of shtick of changing places and things, and sometimes it is necessary. But sometimes we try to change places and things, and that too is self-defeating. Okay? Geographic cures very seldom do anything for anyone. I have a favorite story that I wrote in my book, Generation to Generation, about the story that my mother used to tell me at bedtime. I didn't realize until 45 years later what she was telling me. What happened was that a young man came in to see me, and he wanted a consultation. Because he was a physician and he was trying to make a decision whether to specialize in psychiatry or anesthesiology. And he told me that he was completing his year of radiology residence, but he doesn't like radiology and he wants to change specialties. And then I found out that before that he had been in internal medicine for a year, but he didn't... He said, yes, I was in engineering for a year, but I didn't like it. I said, how come you ever finished medical school? Did you like it? He says, no, but if I would have dropped out, my family would have killed me. So at that point, and I must have been about 50 years old then, I then remembered a story that my mother had told me when I was 5 years old. But I just thought it was a cute bedtime story, and I didn't realize what she was telling me. She would tell me, she didn't have too many stories, so every few nights she used to repeat the same one over. But it didn't make much difference. I wasn't interested in the story. I was interested in her sitting and rocking the bed. So. And she told me a story of a stonecutter who eked out a day of hard labor, eked out a living for his family by hard labor because he had to stand all day with his pickaxe and chop stones out of this huge mountain. And he used to bewail his fate as to why is it his lot to be so poor and to have to work so hard from morning to night, and then all he has is enough to put bread on the table for his large family. While there are some other people that seem to have been born with all the good luck in the world, the silver spoon in their mouth, and they can live in comfort. And then one day as he was chopping away at the mountain, he heard a tumult from afar off, and he went up and top of the mountain, and he saw in the distance that there was a parade. And there was a royal parade. The king was going through the city, and in a royal coach drawn by 6 white horses, and people were standing at both sides of the street, shouting bravo and throwing flowers at the royal coach. And he turned to God and he said, why, if you are a fair God, why have you made us so unequal? There is the king. He's a human being just like me. He is all-powerful, the most powerful person in the whole kingdom. And me, I'm an insignificant nothing. And he says, if you're going to be a just God, then you would make things even, you would make me the king. And all of a sudden, he realized he was the king. His wish had come true. He was sitting in the royal coach, right, and people were throwing flowers and shouting bravo. But then he began to feel very uneasy. The sun was beating down on him mercilessly, and he was sitting in his royal robes, and he felt he was wilting away. And he said, how can this be? The king is the mightiest force in the kingdom. How can the sun make him into a nothing? It must be that the sun is more powerful than the king. Well, then I want to be the sun now. So he became the sun. And he enjoyed being the most powerful force of energy in the world. But then, a dark cloud blocked his action and frustrated everything he wanted to do, and he couldn't do anything. He said, now wait a minute. If a cloud can interfere with the sun and obstruct the sun, then a cloud is more powerful than the sun, then I want to be the cloud. So he became the cloud and enjoyed blocking and frustrating the sun. But then a huge gust of wind came along and blew him away, and he said, a wind can blow the cloud away. Wind is more powerful than the cloud. I want to be the wind. Became a mighty wind, and then he could really do things. Tidal waves blow over forests like matchsticks. But all of a sudden he found himself very frustrated because he was blowing with all his might against this huge mountain and he couldn't budge it. And he said, aha, a mountain can frustrate the wind. I want to be that mountain. And he was converted into this huge mountain standing 30,000 feet above the surface of the earth, feeling all the majesty until he felt pieces were being ripped out of him because there was a stone cutter with an axe. And he says, aha, if the stone cutter can tear apart a mountain, he is more powerful than the mountain. I want to be that powerful person. And so he became the mightiest force in the universe. He became the stone cutter. And I remember, you know, I had not thought of that story for 45 years, and I told this young man, engineering? No. You're going to become a doctor, and then you're going to become an internist, and that's not good, and then you're going to become a radiologist, and that's not good. Now you want to know if you're going to be a psychiatrist or an anesthesiologist. You can become 11 different things. Right? And unless you're at peace with yourself, right, you won't be at peace with anything. Because our happiness does not come from without. Our happiness comes from within. And our happiness will only come from within when we fulfill everything that is within ourselves. You see, the rough ride of the engine will be from the 8-cylinder engine that's not operating at full capacity. That roughness will only be felt by the passenger because the engine can't feel anything.
But you, if you are an eight-cylinder person, and you're not functioning with all eight cylinders because you have underestimated yourself, and you're not exercising those extra energies, those extra capacities, then you are at one time the engine and the passenger, and you feel the roughness of the ride, and you feel the dissatisfaction. And being that we always try to relieve our dissatisfaction with something, we may turn to something or other. We may even run into work and become workaholics and say, what's wrong with that? They'll say, there's nothing wrong with working as hard as you like if you don't force yourself to do it in order to compensate for a make-believe condition. So we could go on. It is quite late. We could go on with many, many other examples. But ultimately, it comes down to one thing. If we want to pull the plug our self-defeating behaviors, we have to get to know ourselves. You say, well, how do I go on doing that? Number one, realize that you may not know yourself. Had anybody come to me at age 38 and said to me, do you know yourself? I would say, what, are you kidding? Of course I know myself. But it was then that I made the discovery that I didn't. Oh, I knew there was a self, one that I didn't write. Okay? And I thought that was the real self. It took me at least 8 years to discover that that wasn't the self that I really was. Now, I happened to do it without the benefit of a full psychological therapy, because, you see, I was fortunate that having worked with alcoholism and drug addiction, that I got myself into the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous without ever having had to drink to get into it. But I began to realize, as I began to associate with people in recovery, that not only does the 12 steps of AA or NA or Al-Anon or Nar-Anon or ACOA, not only are they effective in helping people abstain from alcohol and drugs, but they are also helpful in helping develop a person's character and helping to discover his or her real self. Doesn't happen overnight. Right? And I use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous for my own personal development. This was certainly made much easier by the fact that I had access to a number of therapists who I could use at will, because we had them in our rehab center, and I could bounce things off of them and get feedback. So yes, it is very helpful to have a therapist. It was tremendously valuable to have access to the finest ethical works in the world, the ethical works in Torah literature, and especially the work of the later ethicists of the last two or three generations, whose insights, philosophical insights and psychological insights, are absolutely enormous. And to have the benefit of these works, and putting them all together, I began to make a self-discovery. And my first book came out, which is now out of print, so I can't even push it, was entitled, Like Yourself and Others Will Too. With the theme being that a lot of us do not like ourselves enough. Now, if you want to do something to enhance that process, I've been so impressed with the self-help programs of AA or NA or OA or any one of those, that I might say, look, if for any reason you are unfortunate enough that you do not qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, right? Or Overeaters Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous, you can make your own self-help group. And I've seen people do it, and it's worked out very well. You find out among friends and acquaintances, and perhaps putting up a little sign on a bulletin board, whether at the office or in the synagogue or wherever, saying, we'd like to form a self-awareness group, a self-fulfillment group. Anybody interested, call, etc. And you get perhaps six or eight people together in a group that's going to meet every 2 weeks. The only thing that's necessary for that group, well, two things are necessary. One, close family members should not be in the same group. Secondly, the group must take a pledge and swear to secrecy, so that people will feel comfortable in sharing their own feelings and their own experiences within the group, and that nothing will ever be taken up. But after you've done that, you sit down with these other people and you say, well, let's take a book and start reading
something about self-awareness, self-esteem, and you can go to the self-help section of your bookstore and pick out any book on self-help or self-esteem. There's many of them, and I think they're all worthwhile. Okay. And sit down and somebody read a paragraph. And then you say, well, does that strike anything in any... Anybody want to relate to that? Now, I can tell you that the first three sessions, nobody's going to want to relate to anything. Because the first three sessions, you don't even trust each other enough. So it's usually quite sterile. But get around the fourth or fifth session and somebody says, well, yeah, you know, I know what that's... I think I understand that because, you know, he begins sharing a little bit about himself. And what happens is you have eight people in a group, all of whom are blind to their own positives. Right? All of whom are negative on themselves. Right? But because they're negative on themselves, that doesn't stop them from seeing the good in other people. And they'll react to the other person and say, why do you say that? Right? And begin to correct the other person's perceptions. And the other person will begin to correct yours. And this is the way it goes around the group. And within a relatively short period of time, you have people making awareness of themselves that might even surpass those being made in one-to-one contact in a psychotherapist's office. So you see, there is a way to do it. But before we can do it, we first have to recognize the possibility. Is it possible that here I am at the age 24, 36, 42, 52, 84, that I don't know myself? Is it possible I've been deluding myself all of my life? And the answer is yes. Many people leave this world without ever knowing who they were when they were alive. And that's a tragedy. Because I think that if we get to know ourselves, we fulfill ourselves better, we are happier, we do more for ourselves, we do more for others, and we do more for our children and for our grandchildren. Because almost always, in the fact that many of you during the question answer period are going to say, well, you're right about this self-esteem business, but I can see in my child, I think I see in my child some signs of self-esteem. My child doesn't feel like he wants to play with other children. He feels like he's left out. But what do I do to improve my child's self-esteem? So my first answer is going to be, work on your own. It's contagious. Right? Parents who feel good about themselves and who feel secure are likely to have children who feel secure about themselves. Parents who feel insecure about themselves are likely to pass it on to their children. But work on your own first. And then, of course, you know, the next chance I'm going to give you, I wrote a book about that. And I'm now in the process at this very moment of editing the book on parenting. Not that it's all that unique. There are many other good books on parenting which can give you some skills about building self-esteem in children. There is a book entitled Building Self-Esteem in Children, which is temporarily out of print but should be back in print in a little while, where you can get some ideas about how to build self-esteem in children. And when you work on that, you'll be working on your own as well. So there are ways to do it. But the more we do that, the better knowledge we get of ourselves, the better we will be equipped to deal with the realities of life, because we will have a better perception of the biggest reality in life, the most important reality to us, which is our own, ourselves. And as I say, you can utilize our great work of Torah ethics. I'm very pleased to volunteer the services of Rabbi Edelson and the staff, and all of the other scholars. It's easy for me to volunteer their services. You may approach them and say, what's this about Torah ethics? Never heard about it. Right? And ask for classes in Torah ethics. And find out about what is it that you were created to be. Right? Do you really think that God created you to drink beer and watch television? I know it can be fun, right? But you really think that after living a life of just gratifying yourself, you're not going to be struck with doubt and dissatisfaction? Is this really what I was created for? And then when you begin to find out what you really were created for, and you begin working toward fulfillment of that, then you begin to get a real true gratification. You're fulfilling the purpose. Now, you cannot get a good self-esteem without knowing what the purpose of life is. Let me give a simple example. How much do you value anything that you own?
go back home tonight and look around the house and see what I hear, what kind of things I hear that I value, and why do I value them. And you'll find essentially two reasons. You either value something because it serves a function for you, or you value it because it's attractive, it's ornamental. Okay? So, for example, if you have a beautiful grandfather clock and the mechanism goes kaput and it doesn't work anymore, right, you'll still keep it because it's a beautiful piece of furniture. It's decorative. On the other hand, if your can opener goes haywire, right, and since it's nothing that you're going to display from the ceiling, right, what are you going to do with a broken can opener? Right? Throw it in the trash can and buy another one. All right. So the essential way criteria for value are function, okay, and ornamental, aesthetic. Okay, now I have to come home and look at myself. What's my value? Ornamental? Okay. I can consider myself as being decorative. Okay. Now, there are a few people who are fortunate, they're so handsome and beautiful, they are decorative. Okay. But I can't consider myself as that. I have only one other value. Okay. My function. Well, what is my function? And how many of us thought, what is my real function? Well, we may have many intermediary functions, but what's the ultimate goal? And without an ultimate goal, how can I give myself value? And this is where the concept of Torah ethics comes in. So you see, if you do all of these kinds of things, and you work at it, and it's not going to be an overnight cure, but when you work at it, you can get a self-discovery, you can have a sense of self, and with a healthy sense of self, and a beautiful self-esteem, as a result of which you can fix many of the self-defeating behaviors that I used to have, and I'm not going to talk about all of them, other than to tell you that if you read the book, there's a lot of stuff there that's really autobiographical. That's why I knew so much about it. So, you work on yourself, you work with others, you get some guidance and leadership and Torah ethics, and you can wake up to the most wonderful feeling one day of, I know what I'm here for, I'm striving to fulfill that, I am far better than I think I am. And even though you say, but I haven't done a half of what I should, well, that's all right, so do more. That kind of endless, infinite progress that we can make towards spirituality, that's healthy. Because that's legitimate. It's when we're trying to fill a bottomless pit that we find ourselves self-defeating. Anyway, those are some of the highlights of self-defeating behavior. If we wanted to cover all bases, we could stay here for another 6 hours, another 6 days, another 6 weeks. But if you begin to read more and more about self-esteem, and there are many fine books written on self-esteem, begin to take some of the tips that we've talked about, do prevail upon Rabbi Adlerstein and the others to provide you with Torah teachings, and I can assure you that you will develop a much healthier feeling about yourself, to be more productive, to be healthier, to be happier for yourself and for your children. And thank you for turning out in such wonderful numbers.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tversky, for disappointing no one. Before we prevail upon Dr. Tversky for a few questions. The room does revert to its rightful owners in just a few minutes. I want to please emphasize to everyone the importance of signing up on our sign-up sheet. If you're not on our mailing list, you can do it in the paper version or Aaron. Our website is
HTTP.
Or by internet. Like to point out to everyone, in case you haven't noticed, we did not charge admission tonight. That is fairly characteristic of events at YOLA throughout the year. We don't charge admission except when we absolutely have to. Needless to say, events like this do not occur without someone paying the tab. There are envelopes on your table. If you are very perceptive, you might be able to imagine what they are there for. Let this be an exercise in the discovery of your innate power of intelligence and generosity. Starting Thursday, videos and cassettes, both video and audio, will be available through Rabbi Greenspan. And finally, as we take questions, we're going to request that the questions be of a general nature, not regarding specifics of your individual case. This is not the forum, unfortunately, for free therapy. You can call KABC in the afternoon for that. Or, if you look around the room, we have no shortage, Baruch Hashem, thank God, of many competent and experienced therapists and counselors right here in this very room. And we'll be glad to make referrals.
In your discovery of your adventure with yourself in adequacy at the age of 38, which at that time you were going to be practicing psychiatry, you were telling them on the long run and learned a lot and be very thorough, what was it, and if there was something that made all the learning prior to that point different so that you could take and learn differently after that point? I would imagine that you indicated that as far as a vast sum of knowledge, and what was it that at that point you were able to realize that a change was needed. And such a change
was
needed by everybody at some point.
Well, one of the things that I hear you asking is, what happened at age 38? What was the crisis? I don't mind telling you.
No, one of them was the crisis, if you listen to this time, but what was different in your using the skills that you had up until 38?
See, the problem is this. The problem is that I had described by a peer of mine who was in residency with me together in psychiatry. And of course we were studying about the workings of the mind and how most emotions distort our behavior and whatever. And sometimes I would argue something about with him, and he would stop me and he'd say, Twersky, stop talking logic. And he was quite right. That logical thinking would not lead to any kind of behavior like this. And that if people were behaving in a pathological fashion, it had nothing to do with logic. So that I was in a situation where I supposed to, like the pediatrician who could have looked back on Summa Cum Laude and Phi Beta Kappa and said that they made a mistake, that I could have looked back on my learning and everything else and saying, so what, I'm still no good. Okay. And it was, it took a little bit of self-searching, and particularly, one of the most wonderful things about the 12-step program is that on the fourth step you have to sit down and make a personal moral inventory of everything you can remember doing in your life. Right? A moral inventory means making a decision, was it good or bad. It's not an easy thing to do, especially if you have a good sponsor like I had. Right? Who, after I brought them this moral inventory that I had worked on for 3 weeks, he looked it over, gave it back to me, said, go do it again. But after finishing all that laborious effort, right, at doing a personal moral inventory, you have to sit down with another human being and do the fifth step and hear yourself talk about all the kinds of things that you don't want to tell anybody. Now, I wrote a book recently about the Torah approach to recovery. And then at the end of the Torah approach to recovery, I say, now you want to look at the 12 steps? Right? And it ends up that they are essentially the Torah approach to recovery. And I pointed out that one of the Hasidic masters says that acquire a friend in whom you can confide. And every night go through everything that you did in the day, hear yourself talk about everything that you did, everything that you wanted to do, share all your innermost thoughts and whatever. Now, if we do that kind of thing, then we come to terms with ourselves and what we are really about. So, all the past that I had, like the young woman with the Phi Beta Kappa, had not given me a good enough feeling about myself. I might share this with you. We have a tendency in psychiatry and psychology to scapegoat parents and blame them for everything. Right? And it was my parents' fault. Right? And they deprived me of this and they deprived me of that. I don't want to hear that anymore. Right? Because my
most recent argument, when somebody tells me about that, is I repeat a line, a good one-liner that I heard that says, maybe you are what your parents made you, but if you stay that way, it's your own darn fault. Okay? But I have to look back at myself and realize I have the most wonderful parents in the world. Okay? And in spite of the way that they trained me, in spite of the love that they gave me, I still did not have negative feelings. So it comes out of scapegoat parents. I will say this much. If not for my father's handling of me, my low self-esteem would have been worse than it was. And the fact that it wasn't any worse than it was due to the way he handled me, because he was a genius at it. Part of it perhaps may have been due to the fact that because he was such a great person, I felt perhaps diminutive standing in his shadow. That could be true. It wasn't his fault. But let me just share with you one little story which is especially dear to me. Because one of the questions that you may have, especially young people around here, are thinking, well, don't we have to discipline our children and tell them when they're wrong? I say, yes. Well, how are we going to discipline them without making them feel they're bad? I said, you've got to think about that and try to work out some methods to do it. Right? Maybe you ought to get the book on by Chaim Genat on how to relate to children and teenagers, or other books that give you a little help, at least until my book comes out. Yes? But there are ways in which to deal with it. I remember once when I was disciplined, and it's a very, very loving favorite memory of mine. And I wrote about it in my book, Generation to Generation. What happened was that as a child, I was a chess prodigy. And had I stayed with it, I might have amounted to something in chess world. But I drifted away from it. But what happened was that our show was downstairs and our living quarters were upstairs. And I would come down every day when this was first generation American, Russian immigrants who came over to the United States. Many of them were peddlers. And they'd finish their peddling during the day, and then they'd come to show from Minnesota, and they'd come an hour early and sit and play chess and drink hot tea. And I used to watch them, and I was a kid of five, and I picked up at five what was coming off here, and I learned the steps, and I watched them, and I had a good mind for it in those days. And I became a chess prodigy, so like the age of nine, I was beating everybody. Well, one Rosh Hashanah, there was a rabbi who was at our home, a rabbi from Chicago. And afternoon, Rosh Hashanah afternoon, my father was resting, and the house was quiet, and this rabbi asked me, would you like to play chess? I said, but it's Yom Tov. He said, so? Why can't you play chess on Yom Tov? There's nothing that you're doing that's electrical or forbidden. So, sounded logical, so I played him two games, and I beat him both games. Second night of Rosh Hashanah, I get a message, the Shamit comes in, that the rabbi wants to see you in the study. So I went in, and my father was looking into a volume of Torah. And, you know, in those days we didn't say, hey, Dad, what you want? I just stood there very silently, waiting for him to recognize me. And this was just a stroke of genius as I reconstructed. He let me stand there for a few moments, and then he looked up at me and he said, you play chess on Rosh Hashanah? So I said, yeah, Rabbi Chaimovich said you're allowed to. And my father didn't say a single word, just looked back down into his book and almost imperceptibly, yeah, just moved his head just a fraction of a millimeter, right? And I realized that he was disapproving of what I had done. Now, I was bright enough to know that he didn't disagree with Rabbi Chaimovich's ruling that it's technically permissible, but what he was telling me was, don't you understand that Rosh Hashanah is not a game day, and it's just inappropriate even if it's permissible. And so I sort of realized that, and I absorbed it. You know, he hasn't said one loud word. But he got the message across. But he didn't tell me that I could leave yet. And I wasn't dismissed. And I was waiting for him to say, hey, you can leave. So I stood there. And he let me stand there for a few minutes, and then he looked up at me again. Finally had a twinkle in his eye. And he said, you checkmated him? And I said, twice. Okay. So he giggles in the head. Now, I look back on the genius of that thing. He had to discipline me. And after he saw that I had gotten the message, I'm not going to leave the room on a bad note. So I had to leave the room on a note that he knew that I had beat him, that he was proud of me. And so I got the message. I knew what I was not supposed to do. And it's those kind of little techniques of discipline that we should be able to have. So back to answer your question. All of the things that I had accumulated in the past had not made me feel that much worthy of myself until I had looked at myself through another perspective, gotten feedback from somebody else, began to realize the things that I had thought about that were my defects weren't really defects at all. And after that, I was able then to use all the other things as positives, with hopefully not having become a vain, egotistic, impossible person. I hope. Yes, sir.
Self-esteem,
even over performance, and sometimes that kind of,
what they call self-esteem, can actually be destructive. Could you differentiate between their version of self-esteem and what
you're talking about? Oh, yes, I think what you're referring to, you see, things do get out of proportion, but that, out of hand sometimes. That isn't unusual. When cortisone came out initially, it was being used for everything, right? Until they realized they were using it for conditions that it was causing more harm than good. And if people are going to say, the only thing that you have in life is self-esteem, and don't develop yourself and don't put a premium on excellence, I think they've just started the self-esteem thing. There's no question that they're part of reality, and part of self-esteem is working up to your capabilities. And the idea that anybody that says all that matters is self-esteem, and so don't do the kinds of things that you're supposed to do to develop your skills is absolutely, completely off track. But I've heard that people are doing it. Now, all I can say is they're totally distorting it. And that your part of self-esteem is fulfilling your innate abilities. The only thing is we have to discover more about the innate abilities that we should be fulfilling that we're not. Yes, sir?
They say now the professionals work have found a cure. Is there a way of recognizing before you get into the non-rational state of avera, of self-destructive behavior, is there a way of recognizing either general categories of things that one can recognize to avoid getting enmeshed in progressive stuff?
Yeah, you heard the question, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. One of the things that, I'm sure that there are things we can do to prevention, but probably a great deal of it is if we learn enough about this and learn good techniques of parenting, then we'll be able to help our children do this. And at least avoid some of the things that will prevent our children from developing good self-esteem. As far as ourselves is concerned, one of the reasons that things have bothered me is, why is this so universal? Initially, when I started off, I thought, well, I'm going to find this mostly in people who come from dysfunctional homes. But then I realized I did not come from a dysfunctional home. And began looking, where's the source of all of this? Now, strangely enough, Freud had said that in his later years, that within every individual there is a drive towards self-destruction, a death wish, a drive towards self-destruction. And his disciples thought he was crazy. But he was not all that crazy, right? There is such a thing, and I discovered it in one of the Musso writers, who said that there is a self-destructive force that is part of the Yetzer Hara, because the Yetzer Hara really is only intent on preventing you from fulfilling your purpose for which you were created. And that if he can crush you and make you feel unworthy and inadequate, inferior, he'll get his job done that way. So to realize that when I began having feelings of that I'm not good enough, you have to be very careful. We always have to have some feelings of I should improve and I should be better and I should do more. And those are very healthy. But because you see, if you have feelings I've not done enough, that stimulates you to do more.
if you have feelings, I am no good, I've never been any good, I'll never be any good, feelings of shame that you're inherently bad, then you don't try because there's no purpose in trying. You're not going to do it anyway. So you've got to carefully distinguish those two feelings, one is which is constructive and the other is destructive. But the Yetzer Hara, the evil force that's operating against us, is trying to destroy us and to destroy us by paralyzing us. So we have to realize that if the Yetzer Hara comes around and tells us about how no good we are, then we say, hey, wait a second, aren't you the same guy who told me that I should go eat McDonald's on Yom Kippur? Right? I wouldn't listen to you if you told me that. I'm not going to listen to what you're telling me now. And realizing where some of these self-destructive ideas are coming from and be able to hopefully shrug them off better than we've done. Yes, sir? Is it possible to get addicted to a 12-step program? Yes. It's possible to get addicted to a 12-step program. And my first answer is that if you get addicted to a 12-step program, you're still one heck of a lot better off than being addicted to alcohol and cocaine or food. So even if it is an exchange of one addiction for another, it's a change of a better, much, much healthier addiction. However, having said that, I think that we ought to take the caution that to really avoid any addiction, because even though 12-step programs are helpful, one can use them very well without becoming addicted to them. Now, the phase of addiction in 12-step program is usually within the first 2 years. If we overcome those first 2 years and have good sponsors and good guidance, we can then use them safely and constructively. I'm now hopefully going to be sharing a celebration of a woman in New Jersey who has invited me to share her 49th anniversary of sobriety. And this April, she's going to be 49 years old, but she's 89 years old. I initially told her that I'm not interested in coming out for the 49th. I want to wait for her 50th, and hopefully she'll be going strong at 90. She still makes a couple of meetings every week, but if you know how she operates, she is not addicted. Yes, sir. The question is, how do you draw the line between vanity and self-esteem? We are supposed to be humble. Okay. Initially, when I wrote my book, Let Us Make Men, I wrote a chapter on vanity and humility and self-esteem. And then I came across several quotes from some of our most leading ethicists. One of them writes, for a person not to know his true capabilities is not enough. He is not an anav. He is not humble. If he does not know his true capabilities, he is a shota. He's a fool. Right? Another one says, if a person does not recognize his defects, then he is in a sad state of affairs. On the other hand, if he doesn't realize his strength, he is 7 times worse off because he has no idea of what strength he has to use to overcome and improve himself. So that what we perhaps may compare it to is, I want to throw a lavish dinner, but I don't have silverware, I don't have fine china, I don't have crystal, but I still want to make this lavish dinner. So I go to my neighbors, and one gives me his china, and the other his crystal, and the other his silverware, and I have this beautiful display. Now, wouldn't it be foolish of me, to be vain by displaying all of this when none of it belongs to me? Right? Now, there is nothing wrong with recognizing, my name is Pavarotti. I have a beautiful voice. It was given to me by God. My name is Rembrandt. I have beautiful artistic skills. They were given to me by God. To realize what you have is not vanity. To then say, aha, but because I was given these skills, because I have this beautiful voice, because I have this genius, therefore, everybody's supposed to get up and admire me. Everybody's supposed to praise me. I am better than anyone else around. Right? That is garbage. That is conceit, and that is ego. And so
essentially, that is the difference. One is a healthy thing, humility is healthy, and agava is destructive. Yes, sir?
We were talking about some people, they go through their whole lives and pass on without really knowing themselves. Do you feel like through the process of self-discovery that, you know, you find a lot of different things, including the 12-step programs, that one might possibly cross that line of where they can't get back, and it's just...
Cross which line?
The destruction that they've done to themselves, and, I can speak for myself. I am one of those people that I have questioned whether I have crossed that invisible line, whether it was possible for me to get back, and...
My friend. Now, I'm glad you raised that. I'm glad you raised that because somebody raises the question, have I done so much harm for myself that it's too late? Right? I had a young woman of 23 come in to the hospital. She didn't want to come in. Her parents put her in because she'd been drinking too much. And she says to me on first interview, can I have psychological tests while I'm here? I said, why do you want psychological tests? I'm afraid I got brain damage from drinking. I said, no, don't worry, dear. You don't have any brain damage. Well, the next day I come up and she says, could I have a brainwave test? I said, what for? She said, I'm afraid I have brain damage. I said, you don't have brain damage. The next day I come up and she says, could I have a CT scan of the brain? I said, what for? She said, I'm afraid I have brain damage from drinking. I said, what's it going to take to convince you that you don't? Well, how do you know that I don't? I said, because I know. But maybe I do. And it disturbed me as to why she is so obsessed with this brain damage. So we sat down and talked a bit, and then it became evident. She wanted to have brain damage. Okay? Why? Because that would be the perfect out for her. Right? Now she could tell her family, what do you expect from me? You expect me to be able to get sober? You can't expect that from me. I'm brain damaged. Right? You expect me to go to college and study? I can't learn anything anymore. I'm brain damaged. You expect me to hold a job? I can't take that responsibility. I'm brain damaged. That would have been the perfect out. Now, this is one of the things that the Yetzer Hara tells us, right? You've done too much self-destruction, right? You can't make it anymore. Don't try, right? And right after that is, well, since you can't do any good anymore, you know, you might as well go back to drinking it, or to using it. At least that'll give you a little bit of a comfort, right? So when you say, have I crossed the none of us have ever crossed that. As long as we're alive, unless, God forbid, we have total destruction of our capacity, such as might occur with Alzheimer's or something. But unless we've reached that point, as long as we're alive, we can continue to progress. Yes, sir. What's the question?
I'm not sure. There's some kind of balance inside me between what you said about God wanting humanity to be holy and the 12-step programs which pound us continually with surrendering our will to the will of God. Do we get holy by surrendering?
Well, yes, do we get spiritual by surrendering our will to the will of God? Yes. Because essentially you've got either one of two things. You've got either the will of a higher power, which we assume to be the will of God, or our own will. Right? And we know where our own will takes us. Right? Our own will, minus that of subtracting that from God, our own will is essentially the will of our physical self. Right? Don't forget, all we are is an animal body with a divine spirit. Right? Now, either we give in to the will of the animal body, which will take us in every direction of gratifying our physical desires, and that can be endless, total dissolution, or we're going to accept the divine will, which essentially makes us holy. Yeah, the program says keep it simple. Yes, sir.
Last question.
This one I don't think has been touched on too much. Vaccine looks like education. And I wouldn't have asked it except you have touched on it as far as certain gifts that Hashem has given you. And I know certainly that's something that I am grappling with all the time as a parent, wondering whether I feel very strongly about having a type of a Torah education and a really, not a particularly modern approach to it. As far as, you know, we talk about moderate and not moderate. No, I have very strong conviction tied up. And I want to bring up my children in that way, because I think spiritually that's the right thing. And to do Shabbat and holiness is very important. I don't want them to be spoiled by things that are outside. And yet I see in my children some things that I want them to experience, or I think that maybe they have some special gifts, either, you know, one in particular, incredible intelligence, and I'm concerned, I'm afraid, of making the wrong choices and going with the black education, and or otherwise doing it, going into arts or even thinking about college.